Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Banafsha K. Noosh. I'll be your moderator for today's program called Daring to Drive, A Saudi Woman's Awakening. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Manal Al-Sharif, women's rights activist and author of Daring to Drive. Please.
What a beautiful city. I can't wait to leave, go to Pier 39, go to Baron Candy, the name, and just fill my bag with candy. I love this city. Thank you, everyone, for being here. My name is Manal Sharif. The L is silent. And my first book is Daring to Drive, and it's a memoir. Everyone asks me, you're 38. How come a 38 years old woman write a memoir? I told them, I don't know. When I started the movement back in 2011, it was called Woman to Drive. And it was calling for women to drive on June 17. Yes, this month we finished 6 years. And that movement really, it went out of proportion. So a simple act of a woman driving became an act of civil disobedience. For your car to move from A to B. For us, car is to start social change and push for social change. Today, July 6, we finished the first year in another movement called I Am My Own Guardian, and to end the male guardianship system in my country. Every woman is assigned a legal male guardian that she cannot do anything in her life without his consent and permission. July 6, we finished 1 year, and we used the car as a symbol of disobedience. I'd like to read just one page from my memoir, and I hope you read it. The reason I wrote the memoir is when I wrote the story about Woman to Drive, my agent said, there should be a personal story to the movement. And I was thinking, like, who would read about my insignificant life? And the lady who I wrote she wrote my proposal for the book, she actually lives here in San Francisco. So I came to San Francisco. I sat here with her 3 days. And she called my agent and she said, she got a story to tell. It has to be in the book. And that story really became... There are a lot of things pushed for this book to happen today. People asking why you didn't write your memoir. People thinking that it should be more about personal story. And through that, you tell the struggle in my country. Allow me to read from a chapter in my book about my college. It's called The Forbidden Satellite Dish. The first song I ever purposely listened to started as an accident. One day I walked into the living room as my brother was listening to the Backstreet Boys. I stopped, struck by the beauty of the words and the music, but I was too embarrassed to tell him that I wanted to stay and listen. I used to burn my brother's cassettes because it was haram for me as a Muslim or a devout Muslim. I waited until he left the house, and they put the headphones over my ears and pressed play on the tape recorder. Show me the meaning of being lonely. There is something missing in my heart. To my ears, the music flowing through the headphones was the dreamiest, most beautiful thing that I had ever heard. I could not understand how something so beautiful could be the work of the devil. The lyrics struck a chord with me. I felt truly lonely in my closed-off world of rigid beliefs. And I too felt there was something missing in my heart. Yet I remained torn. I loved the music, but I felt guilty whenever I listened to it. As a Backstreet Boys sang about loneliness, I imagined the pain of molting iron flowing into my ear, because that was what the clerics had preached would happen. Whenever this guilt became too much to bear, I would renounce music for a while, but then my brother would buy a new tape. And I would listen to it on the sly. To live your life with such constant guilt is torment. But that wasn't the only feeling I experienced. Inside my mind, there was a growing sense of contradiction between what I heard in sermons and what I saw all around me. Despite the prevailing rhetoric that condemned music ever more aggressively, both of the public television channels opened their programs with a national anthem, and their shows were accompanied by music. There was a store that sold musical cassettes near our building. Photography was labeled as haram, forbidden for Muslims. But there was a photography shop near our building. A picture of the king was printed on all the banknotes, and his picture hung everywhere, on the streets and inside buildings. It was haram for men and women to socialize and shake hands. But the television showed clips in which men from the government welcomed mixed official delegations from other countries. And the Saudi men chatted and shook hands with the women. I had three choices. My first was to commit the sins of listening to music and watching television in spite of my religious convictions, which would mean ignoring my feelings of guilt and accepting these contradictions. But this would make me a sinner, something I knew I could not live with. My second choice was to reject everything I had been taught about music and television, but this too would have big consequences. Outright rejecting the tenets of my faith would place me in the same category as those who had been excommunicated from Islam. Even if I continued to pray, fast, and read the Quran, the third option was to look for an acceptable way out of my dilemma. But how would I know where to look for the answer when I couldn't tell anyone what I truly felt?
Thanks to Manala Sharif for her comments and for reading a part of her amazing book, which I have read. It's a compelling story. Now it's time for the question and answer period. I'm Dr. Banafsha K. Noosh, today's moderator. We do seem to have a large number of questions, so let's begin. One of the first questions I received is about your thoughts as to whether the issue of women's rights in Muslim countries varies from one country to another, in specific, given the history of colonialism across the world. In countries that have been colonized, in your opinion, do women have more or less rights in the Muslim world versus those that have not been colonized, though I know very few that may have not been.
Saudi Arabia was not colonized. Yes, we haven't been colonized. We only had the empire, the Ottoman Empire. It was a desert. Who would go and colonize a desert? I think the feminism movement in countries like Egypt was very early. So Nawal Saadat, Qasim Amin, with all the books, they were revolutionary, and he wrote them in the 1800s, the late 1800s, and they were influenced by the French, and they were influenced by the British, because at that time they would go and study abroad, plus the influence in their closer. Okay. So they were influenced by these two cultures and the European cultures, because they were in close contact. Well, countries that wasn't colonized, like my country, the Arabian Peninsula, only part of the Arabian Peninsula were colonized. The influence was way less, and so the feminism movement and the women's rights movements came way later, which we are witnessing now.
That's very interesting. Reading your book, it reflects your own personal transformation as much as it reflects the transformation of Saudi society at large. And one of the questions that we have is that it seems that things are rather improving in Saudi Arabia. Is that an understatement or an overstatement? Is it a realistic thought?
Who asked this question? Hi. Oh, That's cheating. She's the moderator. Okay, Celia. She's helping us with the event. Thank you, Celia, for the question. What do you think? I'm asking you a question. Do you see more Saudi women speaking up today than before?
I was 77 last week, so things have really changed. But I really don't know about Saudi Arabia. I read Aramco. I've listened to a lot of speakers. I'm hoping that things are better.
I want to shout out to the millennia in Saudi Arabia. One of them, Samah, here. They are changing the game. My generation, I'm born 79. I was always shushed. I was always told, you're bringing shame to the country, you don't love your country, you should wait, you should be patient, you should not create a scandal. I think this book is the biggest scandal. When you read it, you will understand why. The millennia, they really don't, they're different than my generation. They say, no, I'm here, and I'm here to be respected, to take a decision, and to be independent. For a woman my age, 38, and still considered a minor before law in Saudi Arabia, that's enslaving. You're enslaving 9 million women because of the guardianship system in my country. The millennia are changing. Before, when I tweet or write something, everyone is against it. It's not time, wait. Now the millennia, they're just like, yes, we're here. I'm like, I wish I was born 10 years later. I wouldn't go through what I'm going through. But that's... things are changing, and the change is happening because of the millennia. We have the largest number of students abroad are studying here in the U.S., 125,000 students. Half of them are women. And those women are asked to have a man accompany them when they study here. So you find a PhD, a professor, and she needs a man. And the man could be her teenager brother. Just because he's a man, he has to accompany her. And if they found out she doesn't have a man with her, what they do? They disconnect her scholarship. Doesn't matter if she's a professor, if she's in her last year. The girls, they go to that extent to finish even when they don't have a male guardian accompanying them or mahram accompanying them. They go to the extent to fight everything, to even apply for asylum, to stay and finish their education. That tells you something.
It seems that you're telling us about two parallel realities in Saudi Arabia, one with the younger generation, and trust me, even here in San Francisco, I wish I was 10 or 20 years younger and part of that new millennial generation. I carry with me certain burdens that I don't see in the new generation.
I'm a millennial in the heart.
In the heart. So I envy you, and I hope I'll get there. But the other reality that you speak about is people of the less than recent generation, which were exposed, like you were, to many other realities in Saudi Arabia that you so clearly described. So one of the questions is that given what you went through, and Manal Sharif goes in detail about the story of her life since she was a young girl to the present time, did you ever consider perhaps converting out of Islam? Or, for that matter, did you consider remaining a Muslim but moving to a Muslim country that had less restrictive rules about women?
It's a question from the audience. I would say religion is a personal thing. You don't ask people about their religions and beliefs. This is the first thing I believe in today. And that will remove all the filters we create when we ask someone, where you're from, what's your religion, or what do you believe in? You just treat people as humans, their ideas, their thoughts, what they bring to the humanity. So I wouldn't answer that, but I would answer the other part, which is, did I think of leaving my country? No, I'm staying and I'm changing. So I had no intention to leave my country. I had all the intention to stay and change, because change cannot be happening from outside, can only be happening from within.
You speak of religion, as many of us like to, as a faith, as a choice and a faith. And I think there are numerous misconceptions about faith and religion, especially about Islam. Oh, yes. And I respect the view that you have of it being a personal journey. I also respect the need for bringing change to your country as a Saudi. And reading your book, I was struck by the fact that you enjoyed a great deal of challenges from society in bringing the kind of changes that you wanted, for example, allowing women to drive or changing the guardianship law. But at the same time, there was a significant level of support for you. Some of it was quiet. Some of it was the gradual pride that emerged within your own family, your brother, your father, your own mother, perhaps. But also men and also women of various generations, including among the Saudi royal family, which was also very striking, that they would really kind of enjoy what you were standing for and not questioning your patriotism at the same time. Can you tell us a little bit about those stories?
Yeah, so there is always silver lining. It was not there when I started. So the movement, when it started, there was huge backlash from the religious establishment calling my name on Friday sermons. That happened when my father was there in one of the Friday sermons when I was called a prostitute and a whore for driving a car. Yes, for driving a car. The royals didn't talk in 2011 or in 2013 with the October 26th movement. The royals didn't talk when Lujain al-Hadhloul was sent to jail for 2 months for trying to cross the borders from UAE and Saudi Arabia. The royals talked to only of them. They talked this year because of the I Am My Own Guardian movement that really pushed them to speak up. The support I got from my family, especially my brother, he's my hero. He gave me the second time I told him, I want to drive and pass by a police car and get arrested. He was crazy enough to give me his car keys and get arrested with me. And we were both detained and his car was confiscated for a month. And so, yes, the youth, the young Saudi men, they are changing too. Women should lead. Men should not lead the women's rights movement in a country. Women should be the leaders. But men should be in the picture, should be prepared. When there is a woman president or there is a woman minister, they should be prepared and should be supporting. So they've been beautiful. I'll tell you a funny story. When we started the movement, the opponents started a page, Facebook page, says Bil Igal. Igal is the black head rope that men put to keep their headpiece on top of their head. Bil Igal is here corporate punishment. You use the belt because it's the closest thing to beat the kids. At that time, and I think here in the 50s, they had the corporal punishment in the US or discipline. In Saudi Arabia, they use the Igal to discipline the kids. So they started this page, says Bil Igal, and it was around 7,000 people joined that one. They said any woman drive on June 17, the day of action, it will be beaten. The girls started a page called With the Shoes. And they have a high heel picture as the profile. And they said, if you beat us, we'll beat you back. Of course, I'm against violence, both sides. But it was funny. It was very funny to show that girls' resistance. So if you threaten me, and then the boys or the men, they started a page, says, I'll definitely protect women drivers on June 17. And they were men who started this.
I think that you're really touching on the subject of the role of civil society to an extent and how the relationship between civil society, including women's activists like yourself, can transform the society at large. You talk a fair deal in your book about the role of the ulama and the religious clerics, some of whom have condemned you, and that must have been frightful and I'm sure stirred up so many other unspeakable emotions for you and your family. Tell us a little bit about the role of ulama in Saudi society now. How are activists like yourself able to influence and perhaps change the debate with them?
We try to be respectful to religion because it plays a huge role in Saudi Arabia. The existence, the very existence of the Saudi country or the Saudi state is because of the religious establishment. It gives them its they're eligible because of this power given to them by they are the protectors of the faith and the custodians of the two holy mosques, the king is called, and it's the birthplace of Islam. So you cannot neglect that. It's they're very powerful. We try to meet with the people, and I meet with some of them who are moderate. They're not the hardcore Islamist. We try to meet with the moderate, and we try to reach agreement that we cannot interpret Islamic text based on books that are written 1,000 years ago. We need to look about the era we're living today, and when we try to interpret these Islamic texts, it should be meeting the era that we're meeting today, the conditions and what we're living in today. And that's the biggest challenge. It's very rigid, and it's literal interpretation of the Islamic text that puts them in trouble and also creates a lot of contradictions in Saudi Arabia, because you try to follow things that have been written for the times of camels and caravans and no electricity and no, let's say, police or security. You want to try to push it today in our civil society, in our modern state. That cannot happen.
You speak, what's fascinating about your book and your character to me was the way you embrace a challenge. Many of us might face a challenge and unknowingly embrace it, but kind of be fearful of it. And once it's overcome, they might look back and say, well, yeah, maybe I did embrace it without being conscious of it. But you consciously embrace your challenges. Where does that come from? And in specific, one of the questions here is, were there any women in your family that you felt you could confide in? What was your outlet? How did you find your voice?
My mother.
Tell us more.
So to leave the house, a woman has to ask the husband for permission. Mom never asked dad for permission. I found mom very strong woman. I always admired her. She was a tough woman, really tough woman. But it was amazing to me that all the rules that applies to Saudi women didn't apply to her. She made her own money. She was very independent financially. She would take decisions in the house. She is the one who registered us in school. So that's the woman in my... I think that's how I found my voice. About challenges, when one of my girlfriends come to me complaining, the first question I ask her, what did you do about it? If you're here just to complain and you didn't try to fix it, if you didn't try to do something about it, do not complain. But I can't. I just try to find a way. There is always a way to overcome challenges, no matter what. If you really want something, you will find a way to get it. And I've been through things like where I had to do an exam in a room full with men. And in a society, we have apartheid between the men and women, where they put me at the next to the door, away from all the men. They put a partition around me, so I do the exam alone. I could cheat all I wanted. The examiner would not even find out. But this is how extent. But I went and I did it because I insisted to take the exam. But we don't take women. I'm here and I'm taking the exam. And it was given only twice a year in my country. So there is always a way to overcome the challenges. You have no clue to the extent the Saudi women go through to overcome challenges that are man-made. It's not like God created me without hand, without feet, without sight. No, they take these things away from you and they throw you in the sea and they say swim.
One of the questions, and first I want to say how much I admire this aspect of Saudi culture that to me seems very direct. And I enjoy that. Coming from a society with an Iranian background, this is just a side note, where things are often cloaked in speech because of many factors. But going to the issue of directness, one of the members of our audience has questioned the practice of female genital mutilation, which you also raise in your book. The question is that this seems to have been largely an African tradition, but how does it prevail in a place like Saudi Arabia? Is it indeed prevailing or not?
First of all, it's not African tradition. It has African origin, but there are 200 million girls being subject to the knife in this world today. There is a girl being reported undergone the knife in the UK every hour. It's a global issue. It's not an African issue anymore. In Saudi Arabia, my family, Al Sharif family, they do it to their girls. We had a woman who is the one responsible to cut the girls. And I'd be the first woman to speak about it from my country because there is a huge denial, even from the feminists and the activists in my country, that this is not happening. But it's a tradition that's got to do with secrecy and shame and embarrassment. So the victim would not talk, and the family would do it quietly. And it's all about controlling women. It's all about controlling her body, and it's all about protecting the hymen of that woman that the family owner depends on her hymen. So I opened the door, I would say, by talking. I have a chapter called Dirty Girl. It took me 30 years to speak about it. I couldn't talk about it. And writing that chapter was my therapy. And I'm so happy there are more and more girls now coming up because of this book from Saudi Arabia and speaking up.
The fact that you did not have any knowledge of what may have happened at that moment and that you had obviously no say is heart-wrenching. One of the questions from the audience is that, well, let's go to the issue of driving. There's nothing in Islam that says women can't drive. And so let's disassociate this issue from Islam. And I believe you do throughout your book. You make a clear case that not only this has nothing necessarily to do with the religion itself, perhaps some interpretation of it, but you can tell us more about that. But that furthermore, there's nothing in the Saudi law that specifically and strictly prohibits women from driving. So can you speak a little bit more about these topics?
It's very complicated. Do you have the rest of the evening? Good. Let's go back to 1990 when 47 women took the cars in a protest, the first woman protest in my country. They were arrested by the religious police, car confiscated, fired from their jobs, and banned from leaving the country. They didn't have social media that we have today to speak up for themselves. The story we heard about them, they took off their hijab, they burned it, they were dancing with the American troops that they were there for the Gulf War too. The Grand Mufti, Sheikh Bin Baz, he issued a fatwa saying driving is... So in Saudi Arabia, we have the Grand Mufti, it's like the Pope. And it's un-Islamic, by the way. In Islam, there is nothing called Grand Mufti. It's something new, modern, I would say. And we have the ulama, the council of the ulama. The ulama are the highest knowledgeable clerks in Saudi Arabia. They have a council. So when they issue a fatwa or a religious opinion, they have to agree, all of them. And when it comes, it will have all their signatures. Grand Mufti, that year, 1990, he issued a fatwa by himself. And it says it's haram for women to drive. And he mentioned a lot of reasons why it's haram. Based on that, the Minister of Interior, this is how close the power in Saudi Arabia, the government and the religious establishment. They get their power from the religious establishment. They issue, and they're not legislative. I told you, it's a long story. So the Minister of Interior, based on this fatwa, they issue a statement. The Minister of Interior in Saudi Arabia, they cannot pass laws. So they're not legislatives. So they had to issue that statement, and it's illegal to have that statement because it's not part of the law. If you read the traffic police, the traffic law in Saudi Arabia, it does not specify the gender of the woman. What happened because of the 1990 and the backlash against these women, more women were discouraged. In Saudi Arabia, if you go to the desert and the suburbs, I mean, the remote areas, women drive. Women even use guns, by the way. No, really, I'm not kidding. They have guns. So what happened to the women in the city? Because of that intimidation in 1990, they could not go through the extent of pain and I would say shaming and ostracizing from the society like what happened to the 1990. And it became a taboo for 21 years. We could not talk about it. We could not touch it. No one should do anything about it. There have been some very shy trials to change the ban. But I think until the 2011 movement, the June 17 movement, where we actually took the roads and drove again in the street, that created the dialogue and people started talking about it. And it is un-Islamic, really un-Islamic, because when they say women drivers are whores and prostitutes in the Friday sermons, you are calling 1.5 billion Muslims where they drive.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
There are reasons when we took, I told you it's wrong. So when we took a study signed by 3,500 citizens and mentioning all the problems that we're facing because women can't drive in my country and all the benefits that we will gain when women are allowed to drive in my country, they put that study, they refused the study, they rejected it, and they accepted a study from doctor, a professor, a college professor. And that study says that societies where women drive are prone to illegal children, more adultery, more divorce rates than society where women don't drive. And I'm like, if you look at the globe, there are only two societies where women don't drive and drive. Don't drive, Saudi Arabia. The rest of the world is the other society. And then he tells in his own, in his study, he says, if women are allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia, there will be no more virgins in 10 years. He made the statistics. So it was really ridiculous that we have to face such mentality. We did mock that study. We did mock that. And we found out that nothing strips away your oppressor of his power more than mockery.
I want to bring your attention to a line that was handed to our distinguished speaker when she was caught driving. Saying on the ticket that she has violated some apparent law that doesn't exist, which is really driving while female.
Yes, that was my charge when I went to jail. Driving while female.
I may just stick that on my own car.
It's fun when
I drive around San Francisco for a while,
You do. So it's fun when I tell people, I just talk. First time they meet me, they don't know who I am. I'm like, when I was in jail, and they look at me, she's a convict. And then I take the suspense away when I tell them, yeah, I went to jail for driving while female.
And our speaker is also speaking about an event, the June 17, which she organized to rally many women to come out and drive in different cities across Saudi Arabia. And some did after her arrest. She was arrested.
Some did while I was in jail.
And there was a precedence for that. Other Saudi women have tried, as you mentioned, the 47 brave Saudi women who came out, was it in 1991? And there have been repercussions in society. You talk about the role of the clerics on this matter, and it seems to me again that some external fear often translates into a need to control, and women in many societies being sort of the underprivileged parts of society are the most immediate subjects of control. Talking about control, one of the questions by the audience is about your employer, Aramco, where you worked while you started your campaign, and the role that this this institution plays in Saudi society. It's a significant institution, one of the wealthiest. It's where Saudi Arabia generates its oil revenues, which are very significant. In Aramco, I've been there. It seems a world apart from the rest of Saudi Arabia, a beautiful compound where relations are easygoing and comfortable on many levels. And Aramco does seem to have been a bastion of change in Saudi history in the 50s when there were protests. It started in Aramco. A lot of intellectual thought has risen in Aramco. Aramco itself kind of tried to accommodate you, as you mentioned in your book, to an extent, and you may agree or disagree, and I'd like you to tell us more about it. I'm sure it was not an easy relation, and you finally decided that it was time to quit. But having said that, the question is, well, did you feel that with the loss of your job and Aramco's hand was forced by the clerical establishment in this process? Did they, in other words, influence Aramco to sort of put the kind of pressure that was on you at the time when you were employed by the company and started your campaign?
You mean the clerks' influence? No, has nothing to do with the clerks.
Okay.
Aramco, it is a government inside the government. This is what the former Minister of Oil said about Aramco, Mohamed Zaki Yamani. They have their own rules. They really don't, the rules outside doesn't apply inside. So there was no influence from the religious establishment over Aramco. I was pushed to be quiet. Aramco don't like publicity. They keep low profile. And I had to choose between my job and speaking up, and I chose speaking up. That's when I quit.
That's very good. We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Daring to Drive, a Saudi Woman's Awakening. I'm Banaf Shekay Noosh, your moderator for today's program. Another question we have is your opinion about how President Trump's visit impacted Saudi Arabia, recent visit to your country.
I got this question in all my interviews. What I think of the visit or what I think of President Trump, they're totally different.
Well, how did it affect Saudi Arabia, in your opinion, or may have?
I'm a computer engineer. I'm not a politician, so I'd refrain from answering that question.
Okay. All right. Another question. Did you have any trouble writing your book?
Oh, my God. It took me 6 years, this book. So when you read it, 6 years been put of my life here in this book. The secret is really when you write the book to have a good agent and a good collaborator. I had 5 different collaborators. I wrote the book in Arabic. I translated it to English because no Arabic publisher wanted it. I'm still chasing Arabic publishers because it was written for the Saudi woman. I was amazed that the American publishers were so interested in the book. 4 publishers had to go through a bit. I was rejected by 6 publishers and I lost hope. And then 4 publishers suddenly showed up and they said, we want the book. It's a bumpy, I would say, ride for writing this book. But I'm very, very happy it finally came out. June 13, exactly 1 week after before the 6th anniversary of June 17.
How did you leave Saudi Arabia, and what is your current status in Saudi Arabia? Are you threatened or not? How do you feel about that?
I don't know, really. So I keep speaking up. I receive harassments online, but that's the farthest it goes so far. I go back to Saudi Arabia because I have a son who lives there that he cannot visit me. They use ticks from 1,000 years to ban him from leaving the country, claiming he could die on the road, which is only 1 hour flight. I do go back to Saudi Arabia. Things are recently been very tough for women's activists. Many of them are in jail for reasons that are really ridiculous. But I think we should just keep talking. This is the only way to change things in my country.
One of the questions is sort of a contemplative one, saying that one of the most effective forms of tyranny is one that is not necessarily perceived as tyranny, but it seems to be an overarching, overwhelming presence in society. And since you mentioned your son, if I may, how do you feel about it? I mean, is it necessary for a mother to be separated from her son as such?
I didn't get the question.
Is it necessary for a mother to be separated from her son when a son should enjoy the presence of her mother? What do you think about that? And I know you make an effort to go to Saudi Arabia, but do you feel that this law might change or could change in favor of mothers?
So the law goes in Saudi Arabia. If a mother gets married, she loses her kids. Last week, one of the lawyers, he announced that he won the first case with a woman who got married. She kept her kids' custody. So that gives me hope, really.
That's good. What subject do you think you will write about next?
Amazing. I just love you. You didn't read my first book, and everyone asking about my second book. You see, this is bookworms. I'm like this. Thank you. I'm writing, my second book is Their Stories, because I've never wanted to write my story. And I was overwhelmed with all the interest that people showed. Thank you, everyone. Because of the interest you showed, I wrote this book. So I'm writing a beautiful, amazing woman reaching out to me from Saudi Arabia who have extraordinary stories. And I believe these stories should go out. So I'm writing like profile memoirs for individuals in one book.
Since you did not comment about...
You should help me choose the name for that book.
Since you did not comment about or discuss President Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia, would you care perhaps to comment on the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, and if you think that she might have any impact with regard to the issue of women's issues in Saudi Arabia?
Going back to the same question, but in different ways. So, Saudi Arabia and the U.S. relationship goes back to which president? Eisenhower?
No.
Thank you. Wow. Okay, Roosevelt. Are you CIA? He's a bookworm. Yeah, good. And he speaks Arabic. No, he's a CIA. So it does go to Roosevelt. So it's really, really old relationship. And Saudis being the allies and the U.S. being the allies for the Saudis for a long, long time because of the oil and the security agreement between both states, which is magnificent. What really disappoints me that with all this relationship, very strong relationship between the two countries, there haven't been, I would say, true pressure to promote human rights and women's rights in my country. Ivanka Trump, if anyone followed her last visit to Saudi Arabia, we had two takes on that. A girl called Malak Shehri, she came out, she without her abaya, and she took a photo. She went for a coffee with her friend. And she posted that on Twitter. She was sent to jail for taking off her abaya. When Ivanka Trump came, we took the same photo of Ivanka Trump walking among the Saudis and put it next to Malak Shehri. And we said, so what's the difference? So that created the controversial. The second thing, she said the progress in women's rights in Saudi Arabia is encouraging. Yes, I wish she stayed quiet. Because Saudi Arabia today, 2016, according to the Global Global Gender Gap Index, we are ranked 141 out of 144 countries, only Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan under Saudi Arabia. And these three countries had prime ministers and ministers in their government. We didn't. So that was staggering to me. Maryam El-Ertebi, she's one of the leaders for I Am My Own Guardian. She's a Saudi activist. She was sent to jail for leaving her abuser house. And the crime was absence. 7 days later, Saudi Arabia was voted to be part of the UN Commission for Women's Rights. Women? Hallelujah. Now, Saudi Arabia is in that commission and it's ranked 141. That was, for me, I was really upset. 1 week after Maryam El-Ertebi being sent to jail, she's still in jail as I'm speaking today, Saudi Arabia is voted to be there. So for allies, for our liberal allies who are so proud of women's rights and women empowerment in their own country, I always say use liberty to defend my liberty. And that's what we expect when it comes to politics.
Well, defending liberty is an ongoing process for everyone, including in the United States. And one of the questions is, where do you think women's movement in the United States is going? And someone raises the question of Rosa Parks, which you also speak about in your book. And if you have felt affinity with these figures, tell us more.
I love Susan B. Anthony. She's one of my heroes. So when it comes to feminists and women's rights movement, when you read the story in any country, you can always relate to. You can always learn and listen. And Susan B. Anthony, she used the bike to liberate women in the U.S. There's a book called Wheel of Change, How the Woman Rode the Bike to Freedom. Just remove a bike and put... Thank you. So about the also the suffragist movement in the U.S. and what is happening today for the fight for equal pay and paid maternity leave, that's also for us inspiring. And I think it's, for me, someone coming from a place where we have no civil society, we don't have freedom of speech, coming to the U.S. and you have all this liberty and you're still fighting for the equal pay, it's puzzling. I want to understand why still this fight going on today.
What you are really touching on is something you've also talked vastly in your book, and that's the power of networking and awareness that results about from it. And while I can't venture to respond to your question, I want you to tell us more about this power of networking. You mentioned it in the example of Ivanka Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia and how local networks try to use that as promoting a voice and a stance for themselves. If you can tell us more about that, that would be terrific.
The networking?
Networking. You know, the networks, the Twitter networks, the social
media. Oh, you mean the social media.
The people who have rallied around your cause. And by the way, your cause is not just about driving. One of the audiences says, well, there are many issues that confront women in Saudi Arabia, but I believe that our distinguished speaker has also touched on those. But tell us more about the power of networking.
So to go back to driving, talk to Susan Anthony, whoever asked me this question. She'll explain to you why it's very important. So the driving is the symbol, as I mentioned, of civil disobedience. It's very obvious when you see a woman outside driving, as obvious as at that time when women would ride a bike. Very obvious. She's in the street. She's in public. So that's why the main issue or the source of all evil, I call it, is the male guardianship system. Let me go back to civil rights movement. Every time I read, and I wrote about it in my book about the civil rights movement, it gets under my skin, the similarities. I watch a lot of documentaries and a lot of movies. The last one was Hidden Figures about the ladies in NASA. I was crying watching that movie because all the similarities, because she's black, she was not allowed to even mix with the engineers who are white. I'm like, wow, that was me. I couldn't just be for being a woman. The Rosa Parks story, also the segregation between the black and white, is exactly just remove black woman. You actually have a term called drive while black. It's exactly like driving while female.
We need more bumper stickers. Yeah. So unfortunately, there's only time for two last questions. One question that we have from our audience is sort of this dichotomy again between the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia, initiated first by Sheikh Abdul Wahhab a long time ago, and the Al Saud family. We know that they come together and form the modern Saudi state. But it seems that the state, run by the Al Saud, is anxious to bring a transformation to society, especially now under the young leadership of its deputy crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. How does the state negotiate the boundaries with the religious establishment when it decides that it needs to create more opening for women, for others in society?
Very complicated question. Some people think because we live in an absolute monarchy, the king has the absolute power to wake up one day and say, I decided to do A and B. It's not as simple. We have a lot of groups, power groups, I would say, in Saudi Arabia with different interests. For example, the crown prince, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, he's the one, the head of the Ministry of Interior, who is behind the ban, who is enforcing the ban to stay, for example, when it comes to the driving. And then you find another minister who's the head of the justice minister, who's behind the male guardianship. That's a different story. That's a different group with different. And he's more into, so the Ministry of Justice is more controlled or under the power of the religious establishment. So that's another group of power group, I would say, with different interests. And then you find the king and his son, the deputy crown prince, which they, at least the deputy crown prince, he has the vision 2030. No one has the absolute power to create change. These multiple powers that are in struggle to prove, I would say, to keep that power, they always resist each other. They always want to take a decision. It takes, I would say, arm and leg to go to the extent to convince the other group of power to give away their power. So you can pass a simple thing. We needed a royal decree. I used to buy my underwear from men. I would go to a man and he would sell me my underwear, my panties and my bras. They went to that extent so they don't allow women to work in public space. We needed a royal decree for me to buy my underwear from a woman. So this is how difficult things are in Saudi Arabia. And it's very frustrating to everyone, whether the people in the power, whether us, the young generation, everyone is really frustrated. And we want to create change with, I would say, the least impact and the least resistance. And that cannot happen without changing the culture.
And that's a challenge for many societies. Yes. And also debating power among different power holders is also a challenge. And I believe that in this context, as you mentioned in your book, the Deputy Crown Prince came out and said, well, you know, said something to the effect that driving for women is going to be an inevitable issue in the
they've been saying this for 28 years.
28 years. So that although he came, he's become Deputy Crown Prince.
The self-driven car coming in like a few years before they allow women to drive.
And it's striking. It's striking in your book, you don't seem very hopeful that it's an imminent issue, that driving will come for Saudi women as
a
right
hopeful.
Very soon. Are you hopeful it will happen?
Totally hopeful.
Soon?
I'm hopeful not the state will enforce it.
Good.
I'm hopeful that the millennia will enforce it, will make it a reality.
We'll make that reality. So women will hopefully start driving in Saudi Arabia
when they
sooner
want
than
to. Yes.
Later. And as a final question, have you been in touch with any other feminist groups or other feminists in countries across the Arab world? We know there are plenty of them. And what kind of response have you received from them?
I have living hero, not only Susan B. Anthony. A lot of Arab and non-Arab feminists, especially the women of the 1990 movement. We call them 6 November. That was the day they drove. And my book is dedicated to them. So I'm in contact. We have our own small groups, whether inside Arabia or outside, when I go to conferences and I meet with them. And it's amazing the similarities that we learn. For me as Saudi and for you as Iranian, we come from patriarchal society. We should unite.
We should.
Because we understand how to face it and how to lead the battle. And I always say every man, a successful man, there is a woman behind us. Every successful man, there is a woman behind him. But who's behind every successful woman? More successful woman. Pushing her. Plus, of course, herself, that she believes in her. So this is why I do believe in feminism and such groups.
I'd like to just announce that Manala Al-Sharif's book is available outside, and she is available for signing her book, Dare to Drive, following Daring to Drive, following this presentation. Thanks to our distinguished speaker once more, Manala Al-Sharif, and thanks to our audiences here, those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Dr. Banafsha Kainoush, your moderator for today's program, Daring to Drive, a Saudi Woman's Awakening. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. And as Arabs say, the rain begins with a single drop.